Good day and welcome to Letters and Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich. Today we are going to be in conversation with prominent historian Mei Nye about her book, which is called The Chinese Question, The Gold Rushes and Global Politics. In it, she writes, "The Chinese Question is a story of how the Chinese communities in the West were born of a powerful alchemy of race and money, colored labor and capitalism, colonialism and financial power across the 19th century world." Mei Nye is the Lung Family Professor of Asian American Studies and a professor of history at Columbia University. She's the author of such other books as Impossible Subjects and The Lucky Ones. She joins us via Zoom. Mei Nye, it is a great pleasure to welcome you to this radio program.
Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you. There's this important transformation that happens globally in the second half of the 19th century, seemingly around the 1850s all the way through the beginning of the 1900s, very much attached to gold. Tell me about this story.
Well, there is a major transformation in the world in the late 19th century, and it is all about the integration of the world economy. There has been, of course, trade and commerce around the world from here to there, much earlier. But in the 19th century, you have what you could describe as an integrated global economy. Not everything is integrated, of course, but in large part. And gold plays an important role in this. You know, humans have loved gold from time immemorial. It's beautiful, it's pure, it doesn't rust when exposed to air, but it's also very rare. So it wasn't really used as money, as a means of exchange, until the early modern era. Silver was much more prominent. It was more plentiful. But Great Britain, which went to a gold standard very early in the 18th century even, used its power really as the global hegemon to bring the rest of the world onto the gold standard. But that was only possible if there was an increase in the amount of gold, so countries could have access to more gold.
And this would cause great environmental devastation, wouldn't it?
Yeah, gold was, you know, humans have known about gold in their myths for centuries. You know, it typically is something that comes down through the erosion of mountains, and it's found in the beds of streams and rivers. And it's easy to see and pick up by its glimmer. But it wasn't mined in large quantities until the 19th century, because for that you needed technology, you needed capital investment, you needed labor, you needed transportation, you needed a lot of things that just didn't happen before, because gold was also in peripheral areas on the frontiers of major societies. So, but when you dig up that much gold, they wrecked the earth. They left mounds and mounds of debris. It clogged rivers, the sediment, poison. You know, the mercury is used in separating gold from dirt and gravel. So there is toxic debris as well. So gold was also a huge environmental hazard.
And in your book,
mining.
Yeah, and in your book, you write about when we think of gold and the gold rush, we think of Northern California, and rightfully so. But you also write about Australia and South Africa, where we have the largest production of gold. And the Asian diaspora experience in all of these different places. But of course, as we're talking about the environmental destruction that would come with the gold rush, it was very devastating even for indigenous people, especially in this country.
It's not just the environment that got wiped out. The gold seekers eliminated native peoples themselves. They didn't eliminate them entirely, but they really destroyed their populations and their communities. Indigenous people knew about gold. They often wore it themselves as ornament, but they weren't interested in mining it for money because they didn't value it in that way. But when the whites came and they were driven by a fever for gold as money, they just Well, they didn't start the extermination of Native peoples, but they really accelerated it. And in places like California or the colony of Victoria and Queensland in Australia, the gold rushes really accelerated the extermination of Native peoples.
How do the Chinese first hear about what's happening with gold? How does this process start where Chinese would begin to leave China to come also searching for gold?
Well, news of the discovery of gold in California in 1848 traveled around the world. It traveled, well, first to the East Coast, and it wasn't really, there wasn't really a gold rush until 1849. But it also traveled to, you know, the Hawaiian Islands, to Australia, to China, and to Europe, of course. So gold seekers came to the California gold fields from all over the world, including the Chinese. News came specifically to China through Hong Kong via Hawaii, because there were traders in California who were trading through Hawaii and then to China. So these are the early legs of a trans-Pacific trading network that carried the news. But then the gold rush itself opened up the whole Pacific world to a whole nother level of transoceanic trade.
It's important to understand the history of China of this time and the time leading in to the middle of the 9th century. And you outline it in your book, The Chinese Question. And in one way we could even, I guess, explore this history a little bit is referencing, once again, what you already talked about, is how we went from really valuing silver to valuing gold. And this is a period in of Chinese history that you have the Qing Dynasty, and which was once a great dynasty that was, I guess these are my words, you'll correct me, hobbled by British imperialism. What do you think is important to know about Chinese history going into this moment of the middle of the 19th century and the gold rush?
Well, I'd like to back up a little bit to the Ming Dynasty before the Qing. In the 17th century, the Ming, one of the things they did was they enacted a fiscal reform where they had been using paper money, in fact, and they decided to adopt silver as their means of exchange, both for the collection of taxes as well as for transacting business. This is within China. And so China... This coincided in the 17th century, this coincided with the discovery of silver in the Americas, right, by the Spanish and the Portuguese. And so you had this international trade in silver, where half of the world's silver production, most of which was coming from the Americas, ended up in China. And so China was called the silver sink of the world. And the reason why it went to China was because the Ming needed so much of it that the price of silver in China was twice that of what it was in Europe. So it was an arbitrage, right? People produced and shipped silver to China where it fetched the highest price. And scholars have tracked the price of silver during this time around the world. And the closer you got to China, the higher the price became. So that arbitrage, in a way, opened up a China trade, right? Because, you know, the Chinese weren't really that interested in foreign trade. They had their own tributary systems with Asian and Southeast Asian countries, but they really weren't interested in the kind of commerce that the West was interested in. So they gave them tea, they gave them silks, you know, and the West, in particular Great Britain, they really become hooked on tea. And this is a little bit of a diversion, but I think it's noteworthy that at this time when tea becomes popularized in China, it's the same time, I mean, popularized in the West, in England, this is the same time that sugar, which is being produced by slaves on plantations in the Caribbean, is also being mass marketed in England. So you have this confluence of what were previously seen as exotic luxury items become items of mass consumption in the West, especially in England, right? Tea and sugar to put in the tea. Now, nobody in China puts sugar in their tea, so this is a kind of Western invention, right? That drink, tea with sugar, is a stimulant, right? It's empty calories, but it's a stimulant, and it's actually a part of the formation of the industrial working class in England, right? Where people need energy to work in factories, right? And they need stimulants and sugar.
This is before coffee.
Coffee comes also around the same time, but tea is favored as a working class drink, in part because it can be shipped in large quantities, relatively small volume, you know, and it was available in China, which is what the British needed to buy something with all that silver that they were making money from. But that advantage, that arbitrage, pretty much evens out by 1800. And so the British need another item. And so this is where the opium comes in, right? They need something else to sell to China in exchange for the tea. And so this leads to the opium wars, really the kind of a stranglehold that British imperialism places around China.
What were the opium wars? What were they trying to achieve? What were the British trying to achieve through these opium wars?
Well, the British had discovered, I mean, opium is something that was grown both in India and in China for centuries and used as a kind of both as for medicinal purposes and also as a kind of, you know, as a high, right, for among elites. But it's only when the British mass produce opium in India and sell it to the Chinese that you have mass addiction to the drug, as well as an outflow of Chinese products, right? And so the Qing government becomes very concerned about this situation and tries to ban, it makes several attempts to ban the sale of opium in China. And the British, you know, they just ignore that. And they obviously, they also have Chinese who are complicit, who work with them, you know, people who are smugglers, illegal sales, et cetera. So China in 1839 puts its foot down and says, no more opium. And the British say, you can't stop us because this is free trade, right? Free trade. And so a war ensues. And this is really China's rude introduction to Western gunships, armaments. And the Qing resist, but they have no way to really face down the British warships. And so with the loss of the Opium War, the first Opium War, China is cedes the island of Hong Kong, opens 10 cities to Western trade, and concedes to a concept called extraterritoriality, which means that a British subject, and then this is also adopted by the French and the Americans and others, but Western subjects in China are not subject to Chinese law. And that is a real undermining of the sovereignty of a foreign nation. If, you know, you can go there and act with impunity, you could kill a Chinese person and not have to be held accountable in a Chinese court.
And this hobbles China. Does the opium itself hobble China? I mean, you begin your book by talking about a Chinese diplomat, I think, who's in San Francisco, who's writing poetry, who laments how great China once was. And of course, he's lamenting and how he's being treated in San Francisco, and we'll get there. But again, with the Ming Dynasty, during this period of time, China is a global power of the first order. And then you have this occurrence. Does this bring it down a level?
Well, this is it's a 180 degree reversal of China's position. You know, when China was the silver sink of the world, it was really the focal point of global trade, right? Everything was pivoted around that. But China was also, until 1800, China was also arguably the single largest domestic economy in the world. And it had a huge kind of trading empire of its own, right, through tributary networks that ran from Korea, Japan, through Southeast Asia, all the way to Thailand. So China was a very powerful economic actor. And it's with the opium and the opium wars that it's, two things happened. First, that it's thrust into a new international system, right? China was at the center of its own international relations, right, through its own networks. And the opium wars force it into the Western system of international law, which is different, right? So it's now is one of many members in a so-called family of nations, but it comes in as a weak child, right, in a world where the grown-ups make the rules, and they seem to play not really by the rules, because the rules of international relations is supposed to be based on equality and respect for the sovereignty of other nations. And yet the big imperial powers don't play by those rules. So China enters the international relations world in the mid-19th century in a very hobbled and disadvantaged position. And also, it had to pay huge war indemnities from the Opium Wars. There was another Opium War 10 years later, and then there were other wars in the late 19th century. And every time China lost one of these wars, it had to pay indemnities of millions of Chinese silver taels or millions of pounds. And this also weakened the Qing considerably because it depleted its foreign treasury.
And again, these wars are over trying to stop the British forcing China to take the opium that it was bringing in.
That's how it starts. But the wars are really about the West trying to force China open more and more.
Free trade.
Right. So-called free trade. Yeah. Right. So after the Second Opium War in the early 1840s or 1850s, excuse me, the Westerners gain access to the entire interior of China for both businessmen and missionaries, which is a big advance in their incursion into China.
And is this a situation that then Chinese are finding themselves beginning, I guess, late 1840s or 1850s and onwards, and perhaps a struggling economy, difficulty at home? Hence, they're going abroad with the news about gold.
Right. I mean, it's at the same time, kind of unrelated to the gold rushes, really. China, especially in southern China, has a lot of problems. There's been decades-long internal fighting against so-called, it's on the tip of my tongue, so we're going to have to
edit this part
redo
out.
This.
Yeah.
There's the Taiping Rebellion in southern China, and the efforts of the Qing government to squash that rebellion goes on for decades. And so there's a huge loss of life throughout central and southern China from the Taiping Rebellions, as well as a huge depletion of central government funds, right, to support this suppression. So that's one thing that's going on, are these kind of civil wars or civil strife and rebellions. And it's not just the Taiping Rebellions. There are many rebellions going on at this time. So that's one thing. There's also in southern China cycles of flood and drought, which displace the population, farmers especially. And then there's also the incursion of British capital itself. Once they have access to Chinese markets, they start selling things, say like cotton cloth, which displaces local manufacturers. So there's upheaval that's going on that's economic, that's climate related, and related to the civil disturbances in China. And so the gold rushes come at a time when people were emigrating from southern China for many, many, many years. I mean, mostly to other Southeast Asian destinations. But now the gold rushes opened up possibilities of immigration to California, and then very quickly to Australia as well.
Is this when Chinese first start coming to California, coming to San Francisco?
Yeah. I mean, there have been, you know, a few here, a few there who kind of end up in New York or somewhere, you know, as individual traders or actors. But they don't really come in numbers until after 1850, after news of gold reaches Hong Kong and then China. And then people start to come. And it's like other parts in the world. You know, once people hear that there's riches to be had, you know, there's a huge emigration of people going, leaving the country.
And what happens when they get to California?
Well, the Chinese are a little late to arrive in terms of the gold rush itself. You know, the first people to come from out of state, so to speak, are from Sonora in northern Mexico, Chile, also Oregon, you know, places up and down the Pacific coast that already had some transportation links, right, or some networks into Alta California. And then they come from Hawaii. And a lot of the first miners were actually American soldiers who had been stationed in California during the U.S.-Mexico War, which was just concluded, right, just around the time of the gold rush. So there are a lot of people there, a lot of soldiers, and a lot of them just went AWOL. Nobody could stop them from going into the hills and digging for gold. So the Chinese come a little later, around 1850. And so what you have in California is what I call an international contact zone, right? It's in a frontier area, right? It's undeveloped on the edges of the United States, but the United States has only very recently acquired California as a territory, having won it in the U.S.-Mexico War. So it's kind of a free-for-all. And there's people from all over the world who are there. And they tend to stick with their own kind, but, you know, some of them get along with each other. They fight with each other. They fight with themselves. You know, it's a really heated, competitive environment. And so white American gold miners already had, even before the Chinese arrived, an attitude, which is something drawn from what we call manifest destiny, which is the West belongs to us and screw the rest of y'all. And so they mobilize that nativism, if you will, for competitive gain, right? Because, you know, I mean, there's a lot of gold there, but everybody thought they had to get it all for themselves. And so they attack foreign miners, especially the Mexicans and Chileans, because they actually knew something about mining. So they were the most successful at it and therefore the most competitive. But they also attacked French, Australians, Belgians. You know, the only Europeans they didn't attack were the Irish and the Germans, because they kind of had some kind of ethnic identity with them, I think. And then they attacked the Chinese. And when the Chinese came, they had already driven everybody else off the gold fields, and the Chinese were really the only foreigners around. So they attacked the Chinese.
Did the Chinese ever fit in and find a place within this structure?
I think they did. You know, it wasn't all violence all the time. It wasn't every white person attacking every Chinese person. You know, I mean, this is something that I think is actually important for us to think about when we think about race relations and we think about racial violence. I mean, this is something that's going on today. Yeah, there's a lot of it and it's really ugly, but it's not the only thing going on. It's not every white person attacking every person of color. It's more complicated than that. And so on the gold fields, you had violence, to be sure. You had competition. You had mining districts that had meetings and passed resolutions that no Chinese could mine in their district. But not every district had those rules. And Chinese mined side by side with whites in many other places. And they also did work in the goldfield towns to do, I guess what you would call domestic type of labor, because there were so few women around in the early days. So Chinese had little restaurants, they did laundry, you know, they, you know, some say the whites kicked the Chinese out on one side and let them back in on the other to do domestic work. I think that's partially true, but I think that's also more complicated because they were never able to completely get rid of them in mining.
This is Letters on Politics, and we are in conversation with Mei Nye. We are in conversation about her book, The Chinese Question, The Gold Rush and the Gold Rushes and Global Politics. Mei Nye is also a professor of Asian American Studies and professor of history at Columbia University. Mei Nye, is there a connection to coming during the gold rush and coming to mine with the, which I guess would happen in the next decade, maybe a little bit later, of the construction of the Transcontinental Railroad that oftentimes we think about Chinese immigrants coming to build?
Right, exactly. Yes, there is a connection. The Transcontinental Railroad is built in the late 1860s, and there's a labor shortage on the West Coast. Now, at this time, the gold mines were kind of declining, so there were people were looking for other kinds of employment, and working on the railroad was one option. The railroad companies preferred to hire whites, but actually people who were former gold prospectors weren't really interested in working for wages, for the railroad. So they couldn't hold white labor. So they started to hire Chinese, at first local Chinese who had been also former gold miners. And this proved a successful as far as the railroad barons were concerned. So they started to recruit labor from China. And so Chinese came, I think 20,000 altogether worked on the railroad in that period. And they did the hardest and most dangerous work cutting through the Sierra mountains, including, you know, hanging from baskets out of the mountains with dynamite, you know, living in tents under the snow through the winters. And, you know, there's a famous story about how when the two sections of the railroad met in Utah, and there was a big photograph taken of all the people from both the Western and the Eastern sections. So the Chinese were not allowed to be in the photo, even though they had built the Western section of the railroad.
Yeah, there's that famous photo of two barons shaking hands.
Right.
Yeah. I think most people are familiar about a history of Chinese exclusion in this country. Maybe not as familiar as it wasn't just this country. This was a global phenomenon that was happening at the time. And again, to be clear, your book is not just about what happens in California, but it's also about what happened with the gold rushes in South Africa and Australia. And if we even look large, take a bigger picture, there was Chinese exclusion even throughout Latin America.
Right. You know, but it all starts in California. And one of the things that I really found interesting in researching this book is I kind of assumed that the racist stereotypes that were developed about Chinese were just, you know, repeated around the world. And so that stereotype, which was born in California, is that Chinese were coolies, which was a kind of shorthand to compare them to slaves. a so-called coolie was an indentured worker who was brought over on a contract. And there was a trade in Chinese indentures to the Caribbean and to South America after the abolition of slavery, and mostly the British plantation colonies, but also Peru and Cuba, which were Spanish, used Chinese labor either as a substitute or as a supplement to enslaved African labor. And so they came under contracts, and the Chinese called this coolie trade mai zuzai, which means the selling piglets, right? So it was a horrible, dehumanizing and highly exploitative trade, trafficking. You could call it a kind of labor trafficking. But the Chinese who came to California, as well as Australia and Hawaii, were not indentured. They were not. They did not come under contracts. They came like the other people who went to the gold rushes as independent prospectors. Many of them formed companies or cooperatives, or they worked for wages. In some ways, the way they worked, the kind of labor organization that they had, was similar across different gold rushes. And yet in California, there became this myth or this stereotype that Chinese were coolies. And that was done, I believe, to compare them to slavery in the South as a way of saying that they were a threat to free white labor and therefore they had to be gotten rid of. You know, previous anti-foreign campaigns on the gold fields against Europeans or against Mexicans were just that they were foreign competition. But with the Chinese, they added this layer of racism, which is that Chinese are a coolie race and therefore can never become part of this country, never become part of our society. And I assume that that was the view everywhere, right? It's kind of like you have an app that's in the cloud, the coolie myth, right? And then anytime somebody wants to get rid of Chinese, they kind of download this app and is ready to go. Well, actually, my research showed that that wasn't the case. In Australia, there were conflicts between European miners and Chinese, but they didn't accuse the Chinese of being slaves. Now, why is that? Well, that kind of accusation actually didn't have much purchase in Australia, which didn't have a history of African slavery, right? The history of unfreedom in Australia is convict transportation of poor English and poor Irish. So calling Chinese slaves wasn't going to get you very far if, in fact, anybody who had two eyes in their head could tell they weren't indentured or slaves. But what did worry the Australians was their proximity to China, right? You have to think about Australia in the early and mid 19th century as this tiny European outpost of the British Empire in Asia. And they felt threatened by Chinese coming to the Australian gold fields because they thought they were going to be overrun. And then they cooked up a lot of racist theories to go with that, but it was much more inchoate than the theory of coolieism was in the United States. And so you had, you know, conflict. There was conflict between Chinese and Australian or European miners, but it was not as sustained or as theorized as it was in California. And it's only later in the 1880s in Australia that the Chinese question assumes something, assumes a guise that's very similar to that of California, but it's in the cities. It's not from the goldfields. It's in Melbourne and Sydney where working men are using the Chinese question as a kind of political gambit, right? And by this time they are adopting rhetoric that they are receiving from California. I mean, they have communications, they read about it in the newspapers. So they develop a whole theory about Chinese coolieism in Australia in the cities. It's not from the gold field. So I thought that was really interesting. Yeah. Like, what are the kind of conditions that are necessary for a racist theory to take hold and to have political legs?
What is meant by the term, the Chinese question?
Oh, right. The Chinese question was posed by Westerners throughout the Anglo-American West. It was posed as a problem. The Chinese question was simply, are Chinese a threat to white societies? And if they are such a threat, should we exclude them from immigration and from citizenship? And so, you know, in the 19th century, Mitch, people in Europe and the United States, they often called a thorny social problem a question. So there was the Negro question. There's the woman question. There was the Jewish question. These are all questions of equality, democracy, who belongs, who doesn't belong. So what do we do with these people who want to be part of society, but, you know, the majority or the minority even thinks that they don't really deserve to be women, Jews, Blacks, and Chinese. So the big questions of the 19th century were questions of really questions of democracy in emerging capitalist and industrial nations.
How significant is this then in forming, I guess, even up to today, an economic system that we live by?
Well, what I argue in my book is that Chinese exclusion had far-reaching consequences, not least because it excluded Chinese from the United States, from Australia, from Canada, New Zealand, South Africa, from all the British dominions. And there were also kind of copycat legislations in the Western Hemisphere in Latin America, as you mentioned earlier. So Chinese were cut off from these destinations for work and for business. So that was consequential, and Chinese laboring and capital energies are redirected mostly to within Southeast Asia. So that's one consequence of the Chinese question or Chinese exclusion. But another consequence is that it was part of building a wall around China by Western imperialism in terms of unequal trade relations with the West, in terms of the domination of the goal of gold as the international monetary standard. You know, every time the West imposed war indemnities on China, you know, by the 1890s, they were demanding that those indemnities be paid in gold. So if you were a silver country and you didn't have much gold, you had to go sell silver on the international market in order to pay in gold. But this is a time when the price of silver relative to gold is dropping fast,
yeah,
right? Because of the change in usage of these different coinages. So it was an extra premium then that China had to pay in order to convert silver to gold to pay its war indemnities. So these factors all come together, I think, in further isolating China, really crippling the Qing. And when the Qing is overthrown in 1911, the new Republican government, you know, they try to reform things in China. They can never really get over the position of huge disadvantage that China was in terms of its level of industrialization and modernization. And it's utter impoverishment.
I imagine as we see China back as a major power in the world, it's still very aware of that history.
Oh, yes. President Xi Jinping talks about China's century of humiliation endlessly. It's part of his own nationalist rhetoric to get the people of China behind his own strategies and initiatives for economic and political expansion. You know, this problem we were talking about in the early 20th century of China's isolation, it doesn't really end. That isolation, it goes through different iterations, right? I mean, it's isolated again by the Chinese Revolution when China doesn't completely withdraw, but withdraws to a great extent from the world economy, the international economic relations, and certainly China's isolated diplomatically from the world until the 1970s. And it's only after 1978 with Deng Xiaoping, right, that China begins to test the waters of trading more with the West. And, you know, I won't go into all the reforms that have been done in China. But the emergence of China as a world economic power is something that, if we can just say, freaks out the West. And this is behind all this, I think, quite disturbing China mongering that you hear from both Republicans and Democrats in the United States. And to be sure, I believe China is a bad actor in many ways. You know, its domestic policies are reprehensible, right? What they've done in Xinjiang and Tibet and the repression of dissidents. I'm opposed to all of those things. But I don't think that's the principal motivation of criticism of China from the West. The principal motivation, I believe, is economic competition. And unfortunately, that horse is out of the barn. China is has a huge economy. It's done a lot to lift hundreds of millions of people in China outside of out of poverty. But it's also created huge disparities in wealth. You know, income inequality in China is enormous. You know, China still has a very large number. It's a small part of their population, but a very large number of millionaires and billionaires. So there are problems in China too. But China is a global economic power, and there's no getting around that. So now you see the same anti-China tropes being repurposed in an anti-China campaign, right? Again, you hear things about the Yellow Peril, coolies. Who are the coolies today? They're not gold miners or railroad workers. The coolies today are the people who work in sweatshops in China's special economic zones. Or the coolies are even Chinese international students who come to American universities and study abnormally hard, right? Or Chinese American or Asian American students who are, you know, called model minorities, but it's kind of a pathology, right? They're not like normal US kids. They're not like normal American kids. All they do is study, study, study. So there's, again, this idea that China is using its the size of its population, the centralization of its authority, and its oppressive discipline over its people as kind of, they're all deemed to be part of an unfair competition against the West. And that's how I see the Chinese question reemerging in our own time. It's not exactly the same, but it draws on some of the same stereotypes and rationales. And it's amazing how they're still just beneath the surface.
Really interesting. In the course of our conversation, I feel like I really can see the line of that we can draw from global economic competition today to the middle of the 19th century and some of the history that we went through. And I get the sense we can also draw a line to the rise in hate crimes against Asian Americans today. I live just a block away from Chinatown in Oakland, California.
Yeah, it's terrible what happened there. Yeah.
And it's terrible. There's attacks that seem to happen weekly now.
Yeah, and against our elders.
Seniors. Yeah. No, it's sick. There's a sickness running through our society when we target the elderly. And it's having an effect in Chinatown. You walk through it, you feel it. You talk to shop owners, they're like, our business is way down. You see a connection of what's happening to sort of this larger story that we're talking about?
Sure. You know, when Chinese become targeted as the supposed cause of other people's economic precarity, you know, there's always a violent edge to it. And boycotts of business as well. I mean, these are all things that happened in the 19th century and the early 20th century. And it's really sad to see see it happen again.
Yeah, it's heartbreaking. Mei Nai has been our guest. Mei Nai is the author of the book that's just out, The Chinese Question, The Gold Rushes and Global Politics. Mei Nai is also Lung Family Professor of Asian American Studies and Professor of History at Columbia University. Mei Nai, I thank you dearly for taking this time to join us today.
It's a pleasure talking to you. Thank you for having me.